have a lot to cover still. I hope today we will sort of pull together all our loose ends and bring our subject or our study of the introduction to Shimshon to a close so we can move forward in the story itself. But I owe you one more discussion on our one more subject that we haven't yet completed, and that is the status of Nizirut Shimshon. We spent last week talking about the concept of a Nazir. And what a Nazir is, what is the mitzvah of a Nazir, how does it operate, in normal parameters, not necessarily as it applies to Shimshon, but a regular Nazir. And we saw several things. We saw, number one, that in the Torah itself, there's a certain elevated status attributed to the Nazir. He's called a Kadosh. He has a special comparison to the Kohen Gadol. On the other hand, in the philosophical approach to a Nazir in Chazal, we find two almost contradictory approaches, a kind of ambivalence within the sources. Number one, on the one hand, we find a very positive approach to Nazirut in general, along the lines of Kadosh. On the other hand, we also find Rav Lazar Kafar, who says that a Nazir is, in a certain sense, a sinner because he takes upon himself an additional restriction that the Torah doesn't require, and thereby limiting his benefit from this world, and a kind of philosophical attitude of what God allows, what God gives you isn't good enough. You have to restrict yourself even more. And that ambivalence, those two different philosophical frameworks, sort of weave themselves through all the sources. At the very end of the shir, I suggested that there's one more approach to Nazirus. There's a kind of a third status of a Nazir, not the overall philosophical question of whether a Nazir is a good thing to be or perhaps a concession to be, but actually a whole different approach to Nazir, a kind of mandated status of a Nazir. And that is the first source on the page, which we'll come to momentarily. But before we go there, I want to come back to Shimshon and ask the question from the vantage point of what is the attitude of, or what is the significance of Shimshon's role as a Nazir? What does it contribute to the story of Shimshon that he's a Nazir, other than the fact that it's the method by which Delilah ultimately takes him down at the very end of the story? But other than the technicality of it, how does it play any kind of role in the story itself? We saw at least three of the four chapters of Shimshon. We saw Shimshon and his desire to marry a woman in Timnath. We saw Shimshon with the story with the riddle. We saw Shimshon going back to Timnah in order to take his wife and getting angry and killing Plishtim. And then he has an episode with a prostitute in Azza, and then he has an episode with Delilah. How does any of this influenced by the status of Shimshon as a Nazir? Add to the question the fact that the notion that he's a Nazir is not tangential to his identity. It's core to his identity. And the proof that his status as a Nazir is core to who he is can be seen at two ends. At the far end of the spectrum, by the end of the story, we know that it's ultimately the Nazirus that pulls him down. But at the beginning of the story, we also have an indication that somehow this status of a Nazir is at the centerpiece of who Shimshon is. Because in chapter 13, which is where Shimshon is introduced to us, Pasuk K. When the Malach says to Eshet Manoach, Ki hinach harav yoladet ben, you will have a child. This child will be a Nazir. Can't raise it, shall not come to his head. Child should be a Nazir from birth. V'hu yachel loshia et Yisrael miyad plishtim. He will begin the process of delivering Israel from the plishtim. In other words, in one verse, in one phrase, I've linked the status of Shimshon as a Nazir to his status as a Moshiach, as a Shofet, as somebody who's going to begin the process of fighting against the plishtim. And so the obvious question is, what's the meaning of the juxtaposition of these two phrases, these two ideas? So,
if he wasn't a Nazir, he wouldn't be able to the, he wouldn't be able, may not be able to lead the fight against the plishtim.
That's the question. If he wasn't a Nazir, why is it so? Why is it that the Torah defines his Nazirut as a kind of, almost sounds like a prerequisite? Remember, all the laws given to Eshet Manoach are about observing the practices of Nazirus, even in utero. Even in utero. All of the rules of Shimshon are related to his status as a Nazir. The moment he violates his Nazirus, which is at the end where he allows Delila to cut his hair, he loses that ability to be a Moshiach. He's taken captive by the Shimshon. He loses all his, by the Plishtim. He loses all his quality. So clearly there is an inherent connection between his being a Nazir and his being a Moshiach. That's the question.
What does that mean in utero? I mean, he's not in control.
His wife.
His mother is. His mother is told what she may drink, what she may, in other words, his mother is given all the limitations of drinking wine, etc., as a Nazir, because the child has to be a Nazir even in utero. That's exactly what the verse says. That she is not, atahi shamri na ve'al tishti yayim v'shechar, to go back to the verses we started with, right? You may not drink, to eshet manoach, drink wine, and you may not eat anything that a Nazir may not eat. Ki hina charav yeladet ben, because you are going to conceive a child, and nazir elikim ye'enar min habaten. That's exactly what the chiddush of Shimshon's Nazirus is, that she has to observe a regimen of the Nazir while she is pregnant. But that piece of it will come to at a later time. But the question that I want to address today is, why is it necessary for him to be a Nazir in order for him to be this great Moshiach or Shofet? We have no other paradigm for such a connection. It doesn't say anywhere in Sefer Shoftim that a prerequisite for being a Shofet is to be a Nazir. We don't have anybody else in the book that fits that description. We have lots of Shoftim, but none of them are Nazirim. He's later.
Right.
He's not in this book.
That's true.
Right, and he's a nazir because, as we understood it, he's a nazir because Chana drew the paradigm from Shimshon. Right? So that Shimshon sets that, as almost Shmuel will finish that which Shimshon began, kind of relationship. So I'll leave Shmuel for now.
I think it's very interesting that it's Mibatan.
And it's Mibatan, which defines it as a different kind of naziris. So there are basically, I would say, two classical approaches, or two different, almost conflicting approaches to this question. One, I would say, paints it in the positive, and one paints it in, I wouldn't say the negative, but somewhat more complex. There is the approach that says that somehow by making him a Nazir, the Nazir status, as we talked about last week, according to many of the sources, has a kind of elevated sanctity, Kohen Gadol type of status. And that maybe Shimshon was living on a kind of super elevated holy plane that was the equivalent of a Kohen Gadol, the equivalent of a Nazir, and therefore, because of his great holiness and his great significance, he would live in this world of the Nazir, and as a expression of that added Kedusha, he would have this added strength and quality to him that would allow him to take down the Shoftim. There is such an approach. I mention it with somewhat of a hesitation in my voice, primarily because, as we've said all along, it's very difficult to paint Shimshon. Right. To put it bluntly, very difficult to paint Shimshon in this kind of super righteous, elevated spiritual domain. when every story that the Tanakh speaks up tells us about Shimshon puts him very far from that ideal. True, we could probably, you know, wiggle our way out of an explanation of some sorts for each one of these stories, but the overall picture, I think, is one in which Shimshon is far more complex than a simple description of him as living in this kind of super elevated Nazirus domain. Which brings us to the second possibility. And that opens up, that starts with a very strange passage, a very strange statement that Chazal make in the Gemara in Brachos. I'm going to skip the first paragraph of it, we'll come back to it. But the Gemara in Brachos, Daf Samach Gimel, says the following in the second paragraph, Tanya, Rebbe Omer, Lama nismacha parashat Nazir le parashat Sota. Why is it that in the Torah, the mitzvah of the Nazir appears exactly one paragraph after the mitzvah or the parameters of the laws of the Sota woman who is accused of yuchud with a man? Lomar lecha, this is to teach us, shechol haro'eh sota bekilkula yazir atzmo minayayin. The one who witnesses a sota in her degradation should refrain from drinking wine, should become a nazir. That's the statement that Chazal make. It's quoted by Rashi in Chumash, essentially linking in some way the behavior of the nazir or the parish of a nazir as a kind of philosophical response to the sota. Now, in fact, I'm somewhat less interested right now in the textual issue in Parshas Naso and whether it fits the pshat in the context of the parsha there. I'm more interested in where Chazal saw this link between Sota and Nazir. It's a very strange link. It's almost an arbitrary link. Where did Chazal see a connection between Nazir and Sota? It really is a broader question. The broader question is, it's not uncommon to find Midrashei Chazal like this that expound upon the juxtaposition of two passages in Chumash. Mitzvah A, Mitzvah B. Why is Mitzvah B juxtaposed to Mitzvah A? To teach us that one is a kind of either prerequisite for the other or cause and effect type of relationship. The problem is that they're not consistent. There isn't a methodology of Chazal that says every time I have two mitzvot juxtaposed one to another, I have to darshan why this juxtaposition is there. We don't have such a methodology. We have a handful of instances where Chazal saw a juxtaposition between two mitzvot as being significant. So the question that I would pose is, what is it about those two mitzvot, or about the pattern of those mitzvot, where Chazal identified some kind of connection? I'll show you one other example, and then we'll be able to, I think, put those pieces together. The other example, I'm going to skip for sources 2 and 3, I'll come back to them. The other example is source 4, which is the beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh. Actually, let's take a look at the Pesukim for a moment. Beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh. Devarim Perek Chaf Aleph. Everybody have it?
Ki
Tetzeh
what?
Ki Tetzeh. Beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh. Devarim Chaf Aleph Pasuk Yud. So the beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh deals with a very strange mitzvah called Eshet Yifat Tar. Ki Tetzeh l'mechama oleivecho netanoa shem alakecha v'yadecha v'shevita shivyo. When you go out to war against your enemies, if you will take captives, and what will happen will be v'ra'ita b'shivya Eshet Yifat Tar. Amongst the captives that you will see, the prisoners, you will see a very beautiful woman. And v'chashakta ba v'lakachta l'cha l'isha, you will desire her, you will take her as a wife. Then here are the laws that the Torah establishes. V'heveta el toch beitecha, you'll bring her into your house. Gilchat rosha, you have to shave her hair. Astat zipana. V'esira et simlat shivya me'aleh, she has to remove her garments of captivity from upon her. Yishra b'veitecha uvachta et avia v'et ima yerech yamim, mourn, cry over the loss of her family for a month. V'achakach tavo aleh uvialta, then you may have her as your wife. V'italacha l'isha, and you may marry her. However, if during that month you decide that you do not want her, then you may set her free. You may not sell her. She's not a slave. You may not oppress her. Because you have caused her pain. Tachat asher inita. In other words, it's a very nuanced and a very complex halacha called Eshet Yifat Tor, which allows a man to marry a woman who is captive, a captive from prisoner of war, at the same time recognizing that that is not a desirable thing, giving her a time to mourn for her family, giving you a time to reconsider, can't be done in the moment of the passion, you have to wait a month, etc. And then, if in fact you decide that this is the wrong thing to do, you may set her free, but you may not oppress her, you may not mistreat her in any way. That is the mitzvah of Eshet Yifat Tor.
It doesn't say you have to convert her.
There's all discussion of halacha, but goes without saying.
Okay.
That goes without saying. Complicated story about female conversion in Tanakh, which we'll talk about. I actually discussed it once when we did Megillat Ruth, but it was Shavuos night and 1 o'clock in the morning, so I don't know how many people remember what we did Shavuos night at 1 o'clock in the morning. But all right. Now the next parasha, next mitzvah, which is seemingly unrelated. Ki tiena le'ish shten nashim, a person could possibly have two wives because the Torah lives in a polygamous society. Achat ova ve'achat snua, one loved, one hated. We studied this mitzvah when we did the story of Yiftach, the introduction to Yiftach, because Yiftach has this characteristic to him. He has children, both the loved wife and the hated wife both have children. It's related actually to this week's parasha, because Yaakov and Leah and Rachel are the classic paradigms of the example of this mitzvah. The Bechor ends up being the Bechor of the first, of the wife who is less loved. You may not prefer or favor the firstborn of the loved wife over the firstborn of the hated wife. The Bechor, right, goes to the firstborn child of the wife who is less loved, even though he has a different desire. Nonetheless, he must follow the paradigm and protocols.
Good thing this came after Yaakov.
Yaakov is a different issue. Reuven was supposed to be the Bechor. Reuven lost his right to the Bechor, not because of Yaakov's behavior, but because of Reuven's behavior.
Was that before Yosef was born? No,
it was after Yosef was born. Reuven loses the right to the Bechor at the story of the bed, the switching of the bed. So when he violates the integrity of the marriage of Yaakov and Bilhah, he loses his right to the Bechor. That's a whole different issue. That's not because Yaakov had a preference. It's because his own behavior. That's a different passion. Anyway, one more mitzvah in this sequence, and then we'll take a look at Rashi. Kit ye le'ish ben sorer umoreh. Person could have a child who is a wayward child, rebellious child. And then ushameh b'kol aviv v'kol imo, doesn't listen to his father and his mother. V'yisru oto, the parents chastise him, but nonetheless, lo yishma lehem, he doesn't listen. V'tafsuba aviv v'imo, his parents will take him, grab him, hotziu oto ziknei iro, bring him to the elders of the community. V'yomru ziknei iro, b'neinu ze sorer umoreh, our child, this one is rebellious and wayward. Inenu shameh b'koleinu, zolel v'soveh, he is a glutton, he's a drunkard. He is behaving in a manner which is in direct violation. He's on a path to no good. Therefore, Uragamu kol anshei iro ba'avanim v'met. The elders will of the city will stone him till he dies. Uviatar amikirbecha. You will remove the evil from your midst. V'chol Yisrael yishmeu v'yirau. All of Israel will hear, fear, and take heed. Again, we're not. We could spend a shiur plus five discussing the mitzvah of Ben Sora Amore, what it means, the parameters to it, and the fact that the Gemara says that it never happened, never will happen, because the halachic requirements are so implausible that it's not likely. All very strange sequence of mitzvot. Very strange sequence of mitzvot. What I'm particularly interested in is how Chazal saw this sequence. Because they're really all, the first one, Ki Tetzeh L'Melchama, is actually in place. It's a whole sequence of laws pertaining to war. The end of Parshat Shoftim deals with laws pertaining to war. Parshat Ki Tetzeh begins with another law pertaining to war, namely prisoners of war. And then the rest of Ki Tetzeh deals with all kinds of mixed bag of mitzvot. And if you look at the rest of the parsha, it's a mixture of every possible genre of mitzvah you can imagine. Benadam lechaver, benadam lemakom, laws of war, laws of agriculture, laws of financial markets, laws of Shabbos, laws of Yantar, kashrus, you name it, it's all in there. Came along the Medrash, and in source number four you have Rashi's quote of this Medrash, and says the following. First of all, in the mitzvah of Eishet Yifat Toar, Lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzer hara. When the Torah says you may take this woman as a wife, Torah is speaking only in terms of a concession to the inclination, the evil inclination. Really, the Torah doesn't want you to take her. It's not right. It's not necessary. But if you're going to do it, here's the way in which the Torah allows it. Shim ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu matira yisa'ena b'isur. Because if the Torah didn't allow it, the reality would be you would do it anyway, because that's the passion of war. And the result would be you would do it in violation. So the Torah says, okay, I'll give you the parameters by which we will make it permissible. That in itself is a very strange philosophical statement. But all right. Now here comes the clincher. Aval im nas'a, if you marry her, then know, sofo liot son'a, the end result will be that you will ultimately despise her. Here's the psychological insight, says the Torah. If you desire her in a moment of passion, and we allow you to take her, know that the Torah is smarter than you, and that you will ultimately grow to hate her. How do I know? Because the next parasha is a man has two wives, his regular wife, and the wife that he took is an Eshet Yifat Toar, says Rashi. That's how he ends up with two wives. And the one he's going to hate is the one he took at the moment of passion. That's not all. If you continue down this path, the Torah says, there'll be another result of this very unfortunate union. V'sofo l'holid mimena ben sorero moreh. The result will be a child who will be a ben soro more. V'lechein nismechu pashiyot alalu. And that's why these mitzvot are juxtaposed one to another. So Torah says, so Rashi quotes this medrash that says, all the Torah is presenting to us is a series of mitzvot which historically, chronologically, they fit one to another. Marry this woman, Eshet Yifat Toar, the result is going to be not good. A woman that's hated, a child that's rebellious, nothing good can come of this union. Now, that's another example of what we with Darshan would call smichut parshiot, a kind of juxtaposition of two portions. The question, and it's the same question about the Nazir and the Sota, is where did Chazal simply look at the text of this mitzvot and say, philosophically, psychologically, we see a sequence here? Or was something else driving their sense that there's a connection between the pattern of these mitzvot? And what I would suggest to you, I sort of alluded to it at the end of last week's shiur, is that I think part of what's driving Chazal is not just a textual analysis of Parshanut, but actually an historical analysis. Part of what's driving the juxtaposition was a sense of history, was a paradigm that the Chazal saw of the exact same pattern that they're identifying here. If not exactly, but at least similar enough to create this connection. And in the case of Eshet Yifat Torah, it's easier to see. What historical precedent did Chazal see in Tanakh that drew a connection in their minds between the wife taken in a moment of passion against the better judgment of all involved, resulting in a preferred wife and a less preferred wife, resulting in a rebellious child, who ultimately gets killed because of his rebellion? David and Bathsheba. The paradigm to this story is David and Bathsheba. Bathsheba is the Yifat Torah. Right? Michal ends up being the Snu'ah. It's actually now, Michal is already rejected, but essentially Bathsheba becomes the preferred wife. And the rebellious child is Avshalom. Because the next story after the story of David and Bathsheba is the rape of Tamar, and eventually the rebellion, which leads to the rebellion of Avshalom.
But that's not the exact analogy.
I said it's not an exact parallel, but it's close enough to see a pattern. The Chazal's, what they're telling me here is less about the mitzvah here as much as it is an insight into the story of David and Bathsheba. Understand the methodology of Midrashim work. The Medrash is here in Parshas Ki Teitzeh only textually. The focal point of the Medrash isn't Parshas Ki Teitzeh. The focal point of the Medrash is the story of David and Bathsheba. And what they're pointing to is the root cause of the rebellion of Avshalom and the violation of Tamar and the all the troubles that David has in the rest of his years as king, all the troubles there start because of David and Bathsheba. Because of the story of Bathsheba. That's what Chazal are pointing to. It's working backwards. The Medrash is here, but the focal point is the story in Tanakh. And that, I think, is also what's going on with the Nazir and the Sota. The juxtaposition is the limud, the textual issue that Chazal are pointing to, is the connection between Parshat Nazir and Parshat Sota in the mitzvah of Nazir and the mitzvah of Sota and Parshat Nasa. The focal point of the connection between Nazir and Sota in their minds when they're thinking of such a connection, what biblical precedent paradigm links the Sota behavior and the Nazir behavior? Shimshon. That's precisely the contradiction in Shimshon. On the one hand, you have somebody who's called a Nazir and therefore Kadosh. And on the other hand, you have somebody whose behavior is not so significantly better than the Sota. In fact, in many ways worse. It's one Plishtite woman after another. How much after what?
The Rav that gave the edict about not having more than one wife. Was that
Rabbeinu Gershom?
Yeah, wasn't he about 100 years before Rashi?
Yeah, but that's not the issue. Rashi's quoting a Medrash. Rabbeinu Gershom's decree against polygamy is simply a legal solidification of a practice that had been in place for centuries already. Polygamy, essentially as a practice in the Jewish world, was almost never practiced. You have a couple of biblical cases, primarily kings, but otherwise, you don't have any. If you think about what polygamous societies, Judaism was never a polygamous society in the societal norm. Even the Avot, Yitzchak only has one wife. Avram only has one wife until Sarah insists she takes another wife. Yaakov only has a second wife because of the behavior of Lot, of Lavan. The Shvatim, we have no indication, right? There's a handful of instances where you have references to multiple wives, but for the most part, and Bachazal already, we don't have any examples of polygamy. So even though Ben Gershom is about the turn of the millennia, but it's not relevant, really. Okay. Practices and practice long.
So in society in general, there was no polygamy?
In Judaism? In the Jewish world?
No.
I don't know about society in general. In the Jewish world, it was never a common practice. Never a common
practice. In the church, they accepted marriage.
Anyway, it's way off track. It's way off track. I know, I appreciate that.
Historic, I understand that, but apparently it wasn't a problem. He was just codifying what was accepted. Rabbeinu Gershom was just codifying what was accepted practice.
Correct. I mean, there's a story about a particular instance that led him to want to codify, but wasn't a widespread issue. Neither does it make. Getting back to Nazir and Sota. Nazir and Sota, essentially, what I'm suggesting to you is that when you see these kinds of juxtapositions, very often, not always, but very often, they're based on some kind of biblical precedent. And what I think the Chazal are suggesting is that when we look at the Nazir component of Shimshon, we look at the Nazir component not as a reflection of how great Shimshon was, but as a kind of counterbalance to the flip side of Shimshon's personality. He's got two clearly conflicting identifying characteristics, expressed succinctly by the story of the Sota and the story of the Nazir. And if you look at some of the Mefarshim on the notion that on the pasuk that says that Shimshon should be a Nazir, you see how this plays itself out. So, for example, take a look at source 2, which I skipped before. Ki nazir elokim yeh enar min habeten, that Shimshon should be a Nazir from birth. Galu haya lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheShimshon haya holech achar einav. It was as if to say God knew that Shimshon was going to be somebody who's going to follow his eyes, which is a very euphemistic way of saying
no impulse control.
No impulse control. Exactly. Sees a woman.
That's a grab.
It's actually a very interesting use of the term that halech achar einav, because if you follow Shimshon's story, his eyes play a critical role in the story. When he comes home the first time and he says to his father and his mother, I saw, right? Ishara iti. What's the expression? Ishara iti. Where is it? Perek Yudalet. Ishara iti betimnatam ibnot plishtim. I saw a woman in Timnat. It's not even clear that he actually spoke to her, because they speak in the next part of the story. But I saw a woman there. Yeah, what's the say? I want her. And when they object, he says in Pasuk Gimel, "V'yomer Shimshon el aviv otak kachli ki hi yashra be'enai." I like her. She looks fine to me, and she pleases my eyes. You have a number of instances related to the eyes in the story of Shimshon, and of course, how does Shimshon's story end?
He's blind.
He's blind. They blind him. And actually, if you look at the Radak, hold your finger on the place in the Medrash Rabbah for a second, but if you look at the Radak, just because you were here, if you look at the Radak, in source 8, it says, Onesh Nikirat Einav. The reason, says the Radak, that he's eventually blinded, Lefi Shamar Vatisha Beinei Shimshon, Vatakachli Ki Yashra Beinei. He's constantly lusting after his eyes. V'lototuru Acharei Levavchem Yacharei Einechem. And that's exactly the issue. So similarly, in this medrash, the medrash says, as if in advance, God knew, of course God knew, because God made it so, right, that Shimshon would lust after his eyes. L'fichach, his hero ben nazir. Therefore, the Torah commanded him to be a nazir. Shelo yeshoteh yayin, not to drink wine. Because wine leads to lewdness, inappropriate behavior. Uma bisman sheya nazir halach achar einav, if at the time when he was a nazir, he followed his eyes, if he was as he was, with all of the self-discipline and self-control that comes from the regimen of the nazir, ilu haya shoteh, can you imagine what Shimshon would have looked like if he had been allowed to drink wine? Not enough, he loses his temper and he kills 30 here and 50 here and 100 there. Bad enough, he goes and he's on his trips down to Timna. Can you imagine if he would binge drink there too? Lo ayala takanali alam, there'd be nothing left of Shimshon. He'd have no help. Mirov shiaro defachazima, from his headstrong pursuit of Sota. It's a counterbalance, says the Medrash. Something's got to hold him back. And let go of the reins of Shimshon and you're finished, you're toast. Because Shimshon's got this incredible drive and incredible passion and incredible anger and incredible strength. You put it all together and you have a recipe for total destruction.
So is his Nazirot kadosh, or is it a restraining influence?
That's exactly it. How is the Medrash defining it? This Medrash and the Medrash about Sota and Nazir, all of this paints a pattern, which is that the purpose of the Naziris of Shimshon
is to restrain his behavior.
Is a restraining factor.
But it's so different than what we think of Naziris.
Correct. It's a whole different paradigm. It's a completely different paradigm. That's why I said at the end of last week that we had an ambivalence about how to understand the person who takes upon the oath of Nazir. This is a whole different pattern, because this is the Shimshon phenomenon. And by Shimshon, it's not about the person who wants to become Kadosh. It's mandated. God says to Eshet Manach, you don't have a choice here. This child has to be a Nazir. So we had a question, why? Either because he's so Kadosh, or because part of Shimshon's behavioral pattern is preconditioned. Part of his behavioral pattern is because God wants him to have this kind of passion and lust for plishti women. So he's going to send him as a kind of a spy into the bedrooms of the plishti community and there to wreak havoc. Because he's not going to gather an army. He doesn't have followers. Israel's not ready for a frontal assault with the plishtim. So the methodology by which God chooses is to find a Shimshon, give him all of the personality traits necessary for this mission, send him as a secret agent into the heartland of the Plishtim community, let him loose, like a James Bond, upon the women of the community, and when they double-cross him, as they will, and when they anger him, as they will, he'll exact his revenge. And we saw the pattern. Every instance of Shimshon's fight against the Plishtim is not motivated by ideological drive to free Israel from the hands of the oppressors. Right? It's motivated by passion, anger, and revenge. So that Shimshon is completely driven by passion. Put such a person into a situation where his passion is uncontained and uncontainable, where there's no balance factor, and you add a little bit of, and you add the drinking component to it, you can imagine what we'll have. Lahavdil, the other end of the spectrum, another example of a connection between Sota and Nazir that I think Chazal also saw at the other end of the spectrum. It's also an individual who found himself in a foreign world, exposed to a sexual moral standard that was not the same as it is within the world of the Jewish community, and needed a sense of self-control in order to balance that behavior. And Chazal saw the Nazirus as the factor that would grant him the strength to balance and to maintain that control. Who am I talking about? Yosef.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beauty of it. And I'll show you where it comes from. It's a very interesting series of Midrashim. Chazal saw in Yosef a Nazir. Because Shimshon... Excuse me?
Tanakh never tells us he's a Nazir.
It never tells us. It hints to it. It hints to it. Okay. It hints to it in a couple of interesting places. It's not based on a pshat in the Torah. It's based on a Midrash. But it's actually an interesting connection. First of all, Yosef is called a Nazir. Twice. Not in the sense of the Nazirs that we're talking about. He's called a Nazir by Yaakov and by Moshe. Both of them, in their brachos to their children, refer to Yosef as Ulekodkod Nazir Echav. Take a look for by Yaakov. In Parashat Vayechi. End of Perek Mem Tet, Pasuk Chavav. Bekot Avicha Gavrua, Bekot Harai, Ad Tavat Givot Olam. Yaakov's bracha to Yosef ends, Tiyena L'Rosh Yosef, Ulekodkod Nazir Echav. Grants him leadership. Be a leader, be the head. Kodkod is a point, top of a paradigm, of a pyramid. Nazir Echav. Now, Nazir Echav literally means...
crown.
No. Well, it can mean crown. In the context of leadership, it could refer to a crown. The separated one. Right? Nazir Echav. Yosef is always referred to as Nazir Echav, the separated one from his brothers, because... he was separated from his brothers because he was sold. Correct. Because of the reference to Mechirat Yosef. And Moshe also refers to him as Nazir Echav. Exactly the same phrase. You don't have to flip. I'll just read the pasuk to you. In the Zot of Recha. Yosef Amar Mevarechet Hashem Arzol, the land should be blessed, and gives him the blessing of rain and fat of the land, etc. Umimeged Eretzum Lo'arut, Sanchech Nisnet, Tavota L'Rosh Yosef, you shall come to the head Yosef, Ulekodkod, Nazir Echav, into leadership, the separated or the crowned one of his brothers, depending on how you read the word Nazir Echav. So Yosef, in these two psukim, is not referred to as a Nazir in the classic halachic sense of the term, but in the sense of being separated from his brothers and or crowned leadership over his brothers. One or the other. And maybe both. But what is interesting is that the focal point of Yosef's behavior revolves around the story of Eshet Potiphar, which is your sota half of the story. And actually in a series of Midrashim, Chazal saw in Yosef a kind of somebody who needed to be a Nazir. Somebody who needed the sense of humility that Naziris brings with it. Take a look, for example, in Source 5, at the very beginning of the story.
So is it a punishment? If you're told to become a Nazir?
Well, the way the Gemara describes it is that it's call it a punishment, or call it an exercise in self-discipline and corrective. It's probably the best term for it, right? I don't call that a punishment, but Yosef ben Shva. It's a third model, right? We had two models that we talked last week, and this is the third. Yosef ben Shva Yisrei Shana. Yosef is 17 years old, and the pasuk continues. V'hu nad et b'nei Bilha v'et b'nei Zilpa. He was a lad together with b'nei Bilha and b'nei Zilpa. Says the Medrash, he's 17 years old. V'atah omer v'hu nad. How can you be a nad? Nad is 12 years old. How can you be a nad and be 17 years old? Ela she'osem ma'aseh narut. He behaved like a nad. He's 17 years old, beginning of Parashat Vayeshev, and he's behaving like a nad. Mimashmish be'enav, matla ba'kevo, metakem besaro. He's penciling his eyes, lifting his heels, curling his hair, dressing himself up, looking how beautiful he is and how wonderful he is. And the arrogance of Yosef at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev is really quite remarkable. Chazal weren't deaf to the arrogance. They saw that arrogance. Ultimately, it led to his... Right? He's coming to his brothers about his dreams, and I'm going to rule over you, etc. So, Mechirat Kasev is a great lesson in humility. We should never have to learn it. But ultimately, that's exactly the lesson in humility that he learns. And when he gets down to Mitzrayim, Yosef Ayah Yefei Toar, Kivan Shira'atzma Moshe Litchil Ochel V'Shoteu Mesasel B'Saro. When he started to rule, again, he starts to get arrogant a little bit. And he starts to curl his hair. I'm a Kadosh Baruch Hu. This is in house of Potiphar. Kadosh Baruch Hu says to him, meaning says about him, Avicha mitabel v'ata mesasel b'sarecha. Your father's in mourning. Your father thinks you're dead, and you're curling your hair. Ani megare becha atadov miyad v'tisa eshet atonav. I'm going to sick the bear on you, and teach you a little humility. And so the story of Eshet Potiphar turns around. See, the contrast between the arrogance of Yosef, which is defined as an arrogance focused on
appearance.
On his appearance and his hair.
Oh boy.
On his hair. In fact, there's a beautiful Gemara that says, I forgot to quote it in the source pages last week, but it's really a powerful story. Shimon ben Shetach. Where there's a part of that ambivalence that Chazal had, is another Nazir, a good thing or a bad thing. So a Nazir comes to the Beis HaMikdash, and the halacha of a Nazir is after he grows his hair long, he has to cut it off, and he brings it as a offering on the altar, on the Mizbech. So the Gemara says that a certain Nazir came to Shimon ben Shetach and wanted to offer he was a Nazir, and Shimon ben Shetach looked at him and he said, and he saw these long locks of curly hair, just beautiful hair, and he said to him, why did you become a Nazir? So he said, I was walking by the river one day, and I looked at my reflection in the water, and I said, how beautiful are my curls. And immediately caught myself and said, Chayech, I took an oath that I will make sure that I devote that which I took as vanity to the Mizbech. And Shimon ben Shetach praises the Nazir, and praises this man, and says the paradigm, the ideal type of Nazir. In other words, there is a certain sense that the Nazir is also a kind of self-deprecation because of a balance to the behavior of arrogance and too much delving into the physicality of the world. And that's precisely how Chazal saw Yosef. The lesson that Yosef needed to learn along that journey. And so you see in the Gemara in source 7, Amr Malai Mishum Rabbi Yitzchok Mi Magdala Miyom Shepiresh Yosef Me'echav Lo Ta'am Tam Yayin. The moment Yosef left his brothers, he never drank wine. Now, I don't know if it means from the day or from the day that he decided to become a Nazir. Right? Not clear at what point Yosef has that turnaround. If I put the two Madrashim together, it has to be from the day that he decided after the episode of Eshet Potiphar, when he has that turnaround of humility, and he becomes a Nazir, the very hair that was the source of his arrogance now becomes a source of his humility, and he takes upon himself the oath of a Nazir. So Chazal saw in it. Now whether that's pshat in the story or not is not the issue. But my point is that Chazal continued to see the two aspects of the Nazir as a self-discipline philosophy, increasing humility and control, self-control, as a balance to the unbridled passions of arrogance. And you see that by Yosef, we see that by Shimshon.
There are some that are left alone, like Shmuel. He doesn't have that problem.
No. Shmuel is modeled after Shimshon from all the positive and not the negative. Shmuel, in a sense, is the paradigm, the other end of the spectrum, the Nazir out of Kedusha, not out of the need to kind of balance it. Do you remember we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Shimshon being a child who was not supposed to be? You know, we talked about the Akarut, the notion that the mother was an Akara, was barren. And because she was barren, the symbolism of her being barren was that, as if to say, really this child never should have come into being. The Ribbono Shel Olam puts Shimshon into this world for a particular mission. And hence, his accountability is different from the accountability of every other human being. For any other Jewish person, the behavior of Shimshon would have been considered horrible. But for Shimshon, it's expected, because that's what God's programmed him to be. He's literally programmed to find Plishtim women and to lust for them and to anger Plishtim and to get and to kill. That's how he's programmed. Which raised, of course, the question in our minds of free will and the challenge of free will, and how do you have an individual who's completely unaccountable before the Ribbono Shel Olam? I thought I'd come back to that answer, to that question. I think the answer is this. Shimshon is, in fact, Shimshon is a pre-programmed, I would hate to call him a robot, but I think to some extent that's what he is. He's a pre-programmed individual, somebody whose free will is in fact denied to him on most levels, because his mission, his purpose in this world is defined by his mission. But at the same time, he's given one arena in which to operate solely in a world of free will. And that arena is his Nazirus. And what I'm suggesting to you is that the Nazirus isn't just a balance to the passion, it's also the test of his free will. He's not accountable for his lust for the women. He's not accountable for his anger against the Plishtim, and he's not accountable for his passion and his anger and his strength and his hatred and his killing execution style of Plishtim. Where is he accountable? His loyalty to the Oath of Nazirus. As long as he remains loyal there, he exercises free will on that domain.
But just that.
Everything else is programmed by God. The arena in which he exercises free will and he remains a human being because he has an arena of free will is specifically the arena of his Nazirus.
So is that the same case for Shmuel, who's on the opposite end?
No, Shmuel's a different person altogether because he's not mandated by God, etc. Shmuel's a different operation altogether. When we talk about Shmuel, when we learn Sefer Shmuel, we'll come back to Shmuel. I only drew the connection at the very beginning because it helped us understand a little bit about Eshet Manoach. It's not really the same level of it all.
Free will.
Shmuel operates in a completely different level of free will. Shmuel is completely free will. He's not pre-programmed as Shimshon. Shimshon is pre-programmed from the outset to have this kind of behavioral pattern that is inappropriate, but appropriate for him. That's what the text says. Tonao Mivakesh, Ribbono Shel Olam programmed it. But the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him one arena in which to operate and to be held accountable.
But when you started your discussion, you said, was he a thug or not? So
right.
Now I'm looking at him a different way, because you're making it sound like, well, he's doing these things because Hashem has given him this mission.
Correct.
The only way where you see his own personality then is the Nazirus.
Correct.
So he isn't really, I'm looking at him a totally different perspective.
Good. I'm glad, because I wasn't prepared to end with the conclusion that he was a thug. He's a shofet of the Tanakh.
I know, but you've been like, we've gone full circle.
We have. We brought it all together. That's exactly correct. But because that's the complexity of Shimshon. He's not black and white. His thug-like behavior is pre-programmed. His accountability is in the arena of his Nazirus. And there's proof to this theory.
He's a robot
in every arena except
the
Nazirus. And where is he held accountable in the end? And that's what the Radak points out. He's not accountable. The Nebi Nevot says, how dare you lust for Plishtim women, and how dare you find a prostitute, and how dare you... Nebi Nevot holds him accountable for any of those things. The only thing he's ever held accountable for is the one time when he violates his Naziris. And it's not just because he got tricked into violating his Naziris. The test of Delilah was a test between the conflict of these two arenas, the Sota and the Nazir. And it was intentional. When Shimshon says to Delilah, the secret's in my hair, right? That wasn't an accident. It wasn't a moment of weakness. If you read the Perek, we have 10 minutes left, but we'll read the Perek. Read the Perek, and you see that Shimshon knew exactly what he was doing. He was making a choice. And the choice was to choose the Sota over the Naziris, finally, once and for all. And the moment he does that, he fails. But if you read this, it's a remarkable story. It's the last, second to last piece of Shimshon's life. Perek Tet Zayin. Starting with Pasuk Dalet. Vayirch Reichen Vayahav Isha Benachal Serek Ushmad Lila. After previous episodes, Shimshon fell in love with a woman in Nachal Serek. Her name was Delilah. She's a Plishtit. Vayalu Aleh Sarnei Plishtim. So the elders of the Plishtit community came to her. Vayamula Pati Oto. Seduce him. Uri'i Bameh Kocho Gadol. Find out the secret of his great strength. How can we overcome him? How can we subdue him to afflict him? We want to torture him. Tell us how we can do so. Now, if you remember the story of the first wife that Shimshon had, when they came to her and they said, seduce him for us. What did they say? Seduce him for us. Why would she betray her husband? So they threatened her. Remember? We'll raise you to the ground. Here, they don't threaten her. They bribe her. Just to give you a sense of who she is compared to who the first woman was. Right? They bribe her. Each one of us will give you 1,100 talents of silver. That one night, Shimshon comes home. Lila says to him, what's the secret of your strength? How can you be subdued? So Shimshon makes up a story. If you tie me up with seven wet, fresh ropes, moist ropes, and not dry, then I will be like nothing. I'll be like just an ordinary person. So, so the Plishtim brought her seven fresh, moist ropes, not dry, and she tied them up. And there's an ambush. A couple of Plishtim are lying ambush in the wait in the room. She says to him in the middle of the night, Plishtim alacha Shimshon! Shimshon, the Plishtim are after you! He ripped off those ropes like wicks in a fire, just melted away. And therefore, the secret of his strength was unknown. Now, what do you think is going to happen next? You've made fun of me. But they're like, Savim, you lied to me. I don't know. Is Shimshon the one who was deceitful here? last I checked, she took advantage of what he told her, and she tried to
kill him.
Kill him, subdue him. I really want to know the secret of what you can be, of how you can be tied up. So he says to her, אם עשור יעשוני באבותים חדשים שלא נעשה בהם מלאכה, וחלית ואיתי כחד האדם. They need to be fresh ropes that have never been used before. If they're fresh ropes that have never been used before, then I can be subdued.
He doesn't know what's going on.
Well, that's the mystery of this parak. This parak is really quite unintelligible. Once, maybe. Twice, give it the benefit of the doubt. Vatikach lila avotim chadashim, so she takes these fresh ropes, vatasreu behem, she ties them up, vatomer la plishtim alech ha-shimshon, she says, oh, the plishtim are attacking. Vanev yoshev b'chadar, in the ambush of the plishtim are in the room, atkeh me'azro atav kachut, and he rips them off like the threads. So, now that's time number two, right? Vatomer lila ha-shimshon, ad hena hitalt bi. How long are you going to make fun of me? Mock me. Vatadaber like Zavim. Lie to me. Hagidali b'mati aser. I want to know how you can be tied up, how you can be subdued. So a third time, Vayom Eleim Targi et Sheva Machlafot Roshim Masachet, to tie the seven locks of my curls to the pins that hold the tent. Vatitka b'yated. So she ties up those locks of hair to the posts. Vatomer la plishtim alecha Shimshon. Shimshon, the plishtim are attacking. Vayikatz mishnato, he wakes up. Vayisat ayatad et arek vatamasachet. It's actually the pins are not of the tent, they're of the loom. So he stands up and he takes the loom with him. Okay.
Why are they making him out to be so
stupid? Right? Yeah. I don't think he's stupid at all. I'll tell you what I think he is in a moment. I don't think he's stupid at all. But that's the impression that you get. I mean, this is third time, right? Mm-hmm. Now look what happens. Vatomer elav. Eich tomar ahavtich v'lipcha en iti. Shimshon, how can you say you love me when you won't tell me the truth? Say, shalosh pamim mitalt bi. V'lo higida higadata li b'mekochacha gadol. 3 times you've lied to me. She nudged him, kvetched at him. She kvetched so much that he was ready to die. So he finally told her the secret of his heart. No razor, no scissors has ever come to my hair. I have been a Nazir from birth. Im gulachti, if you shave me, if you cut my hair, sar mimeni kochi vechaliti veitikacha kocholada. Then I will be like every man. And she says, vatemet lilaki yigidalat kolibo. This time she got it. She saw that he was truthful. So vatishlach, vatikrala sanei plishtim. She goes, she calls the plishtim, she's going to come over. And they said, okay, we got it this time, it's real. So what's going on? Is he an idiot? I don't think he's an idiot. There are 2 things that are going on in this parasha, and I think they're interconnected. One is he made a calculated choice. And the calculated choice was to give up his nazirus for her.
But he knew he would die.
The second dynamic of this parasha is that he knew he would die. Yeah. And what's going on within the dynamic, we'll get to that, come back to this when we learn about it in depth, what's going on in the dynamic of this passage of this parak is that Shimshon has given up.
He had enough.
We don't know why.
We will when we get there. But Shimshon essentially has given up. And his choice to give up is by handing in
his credentials.
His credentials as a Nazir.
That's what he's giving up. But what was
that? Because that's where his accountability is. That's where his free will is. That's what's holding him in place. You give up the Nazirus, it's gone. Everything about Shimshon is now up for grabs because he has no raison d'etre. Yeah. It's not just a pre-programmed robot. It's a Shimshon with a mission and with an accountability in the arena of his Naziris. That's the core piece of it. The moment he gives up willingly his status as a Nazir, everything unravels. And the rest of the story is the end of his life. That's what the story concludes.
But what's the purpose of the three times? I mean, if he's giving
up... Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get to the parak. Okay. We just read the parak, but okay. I wanted you to see the whole picture. Okay. Bezrat Hashem, next week. We begin the textual analysis of chapter 13, which is the relationship between Manoach and his wife.